raid or a mission in particular that you can think of that you'd like to talk about?
Obama Command was made up of six groups. One group was the first one, of course. That's who I started flying with 12 Squadron, called the Little Foxes. After seven trips there, four trips out of that squadron, we volunteered for Pathfinder duty. The Pathfinders were a select group formed by Air Vice Marshal Bennett, who was shot down flying a Hamden, old Hamden, we call him the Flying Coffin, and he managed to get back to Britain. But while he was walking back, he noticed the bombing raids. Bombs were falling anywhere but on the target. So he went to Bomber Harris and another man, group captain. I can't remember that either right now. But they formed, the idea he had was take all the best crews from all the squadrons and groups, take the best crews and make one super group with six squadrons. They were going to have five, but then they thought they'd better bring in the Canadians, and they made six group, Canadian group. Pathfinders were eight group. I've forgotten which one the dam busters were on, but I damn near flew on it, except I caught the scarlet fever and I couldn't fly that.
Oh, you were, really?
Yeah, I almost was on it.
So were you training with those dam busters?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I got that with scarlet fever and I was out for 3 months, 2 months. So when we got the Pathfinders, they'd find the target, and initially when I joined them, they were dropping flares at the turning point. They had a route to fly to the target. They dropped flare at the turning point. And if you are there on time, you can tell whether you're there or not, because their accuracy rate, navigation-wise, but to get to a target with a practically no room for error, and they were there in seconds, sort of thing. Sometimes big winds could upset it, but by and large they were on target right on time. And they'd mark the target and keep it marked. And this was done by staggering Pathfinder aircraft through this bomber stream. One here, one here, one there. And if the flare burned out, he'd call in the next guy to come in and drop it. If he was there too early and the flare was still burning, he'd fly around, it was time to drop it, he'd drop another flare and keep the target marked. One of the problems we had with target marking was human nature. You're bombing a target here, and pretty soon more aircraft following up, they get almost to it and say, that's close enough, and they drop the bombs and peel off. So the bombing target seemed to be working backwards, away from where it's supposed to be. So we'd have to, master bomber's job was to get it remarked up where it's supposed to be. We always had that. And I noticed, looking back, I saw a lot of things. Like coming across the North Sea on reefs quite often, there was always a bunch of big blasts down over the ocean. And those were cookies, 4,000 pounders that people didn't want to carry over the target. Because if a piece of flak hit it and it went off, you're gone. I mean, there's nothing left. But they had, and I recall one chap who went out on every mission, but he never went to the target. I don't know who it was, what squadron or anything, but he took off with the regular crew, got over the North Sea, and he'd just peel off and fly up and down the North Sea until it was time for the main team bomber to come back, and then he'd join it, come back. And he'd tend to come back a little on the early side. But he wouldn't be interviewed by the interrogation officer until near the end, which gave him lots of time to talk to the crews that came back and find out what really happened. And he'd have a hell of a story to tell, because they were going to give him medals all over the place. But somebody got suspicious. And they put a double IFF machinery in his aircraft. One that he knows is there, but and another one he didn't know, and it's radioing back to England what he's tracking, where he is. And that's how they caught him. And they sent the whole crew to the, what they called the glass house.
Yeah.
It was a terrible place where they didn't hit you, they didn't beat you, but they just terrorized you. They take the guts right out of you.
Right.
You'd have, well, I know one of the things that I was heard about was a tower with the, that you started off with two buckets. One was empty and the one was full of water. And the empty one you put down below a spout at the bottom of the tower. It was about 3 stories high. The other one you ran up the tower, dumped it into a funnel, went down, filled up the bottom, then went around, put that up, and you did that for several hours. And the first thing you did was a haircut, a bald haircut when you got up there. This was to break your spirit. And they did. We had one that quit on us. And they caught him and he went to the glass house. He was on our first trip. And he got off the aircraft and he gets on, he kissed the ground, he said, "This is for the flapping birds." He said, "The hell with it," and he went out, he just left.
Yeah. So this was for punishment for people who were flying their missions and who were going off course?
Well, now you could easily get lost over course, but deliberately avoiding.
Yeah, deliberately avoiding.
Battle, yeah, that was cowardice, and yeah. They called it lack of moral fiber in the second war, and it was cowardice in the first war. And they shot them in the first war.
I read about how there was lots of suspicion about that. Sometimes people would say that their planes weren't ready to go when they'd go in for a check afterwards after the mission had taken off, and their planes would be fine, and how some guys would turn back early and there was no reports, no reason why they should have. Was this a common thing?
We turned back on our second mission, an abort mission, because the mags were dropping.
Yeah.
You know, I never understood. The mags had something to do with the monitoring of all the engines, that everything was working right. And they were all over the place, they were falling, and if you kept on going, you'd actually just fall into the ocean.
Oh, okay.
But there was no, you never knew. But our skipper said, the engineer says, "I can't control these things, they're all over the place. We don't have control over the engines." And the skipper elected to take it home again. We were only out there about 2.5 hours. And he went back, and we landed fine, everything was fine, all the way back. And I thought, geez, I felt like a traitor or something, not going, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he went on down to Pathfinders with us until we got broken up by Black. And he was sent off to India, flying over there. Dakota instead of Lancaster, what a drop. And Dakota was the best aircraft for travel they ever had. It's still going. The DC-3, but the Lancaster was the queen of the bombers.
Mm-hmm.
Halifaxes, the 6th group, the Canadians flew mostly Halifaxes, and they were a good bird. They were good right up to 10,000 feet. Now this is hearsay, I'm telling you, because this is what I've been told by some of the guys who flew them. He said, "We would pass you guys climbing out." He said, "Bye bye, like," and they fly up. They hit 10,000 feet of that altitude around there, and then it started getting hard to climb. But the Lancaster would then pass them to 18,000-20,000.
Right. Lancaster was the superior bomber at the time, then.
Oh, yeah. The Yanks will tell you all kinds of stuff, but the best stories have never been told.
Right on. So most of the missions that you were flying, did those take place at night, then?
Most of them at night. I had about five or six daytime ones. I'm trying to find something here that would give you an idea of what happened. I better keep that in there.
Did you feel safer flying at night, or was it?
No.
No?
If you didn't hit somebody, collision, or get lost, or run out of petrol and just ram into somebody. Look how thick they are there, and they're 10 times up in actual fact.
Mm-hmm.
You'd put 700 bombers over a target in less than half an hour.
Right.
And they worry about getting close to each other. Here's a picture. That's Hanover. During the raid and afterwards, there isn't a roof on any building there.
Wow.
And who's that? That's Lancaster. A couple of thousand feet below us. Why the hell they went down there? Maybe they got the pointing all the flak or whatever they were giving a problem. Or maybe it was... I always thought to put down, get above it. Don't shoot down below, you're going to get hit. And it happened. I can find it. There, 4,000 product, and the rest of those are all canisters of incendiaries. There's another one with a cookie there, and these are 1,000 pounders or 500. They're probably 500 pounders. There'll be six here and six behind. That way, 4,000. Your bomb load was dependent on how much gas you needed to get to the target. All up weight was 64,000 pounds. And if you worked out how much gas you needed to get there, and then what was left, you could fill up with bombs. Mm-hmm. So to short targets, you could take 16,000 pounds. To Berlin, it was probably about 8. I don't really recall, but it says... I feel like I got some stuff missing here. What is it? It's a picture of a hole in the top of a Lancaster, a hole right through it, that a bomb fell through there. I was in the mid-upper turret and chong, right behind me. Well, there's more to that story because the bomb went through the Elson can, too. The Elson can was a 5-gallon bucket with about a gallon of creosote in it. It was a toilet.
Oh, yeah.
Had a lid on it. Peekable Breakwell was an Australian who, when he came to us, he had already flown two tours in Africa. And he was in his 60th tour or so when we got him. He was a practical joker. Always, he'd like to go down to London and Fleet Street and, tops down there with their top hats and whatnot. And he was worn out and he had swagger stick and he'd take the chair and flip their hats off. And he laughed like hell because he was a goddamn colonial Canadian. He wasn't a Canadian, he was an Australian, but he joined up in Canada because when he was touring the States, he was told if he goes to Canada, he said, you're not back in 3 days, you're going to be put in the army. But he woke up in the gutter somewhere and he got away over late, so he stopped there to volunteer rather than be shelved. So he walked into the nearest recruiting office and it was in Montreal. And they put him in the army, and they were speaking French, and he couldn't understand that, but I don't know how he did it, but one way or the other, he got into the Air Force. And he did all this. And he gets over to England, and his favorite hobby when he was on leave was to go down to the Peekaboo Club, which was a stage, a girly stage, and the girls were all poised there. They weren't allowed to move. The curtain would go up, and they'd all be poised in very, very poised. Poses, and when you give them a minute or two and they close the curtains and then change the position and whatnot, open the curtain again. It's called the Peekaboo Clown. So that's how he got his name. Well, he was the rear gunner that night, and this bomb went through the aircraft, split the Elson can, and we didn't tell him. His intercom was taken out somehow or other. We didn't tell him, so we landed very gently, put the tail wheel down, we got in. He climbed out over the tailplane of the aircraft and stepped down to where the Elson can was with the stepping stone down the floor of the aircraft. Because it wasn't there, he fell right through the damn thing. Cleaned it up on the way down. So he stunk so bad that with a flight van to take us back to the dressing room, we wouldn't let him on. He had to walk a mile back with all his gear. I think it cured him, too. There are all kinds of characters. I've got one chapter on characters in it. Yeah, I'm taking it.
What year was that then? Or
around? That would have been 44.
44?
Yeah.
So you were flying missions. When was the first mission you flew? What year was that?
43, I think.
Oh, 42. Okay. Oh, yeah, you... Yeah, I got that. And how many missions did you fly?
55 completed ones.
55?
Yeah.
And 30 was one tour, right?
Yeah. But if you did a second tour with Pathfinders, it was only 20. Because you were... They would do more dangerous missions. So you'd be the first one in, facing, you'd stir up all the flak, you took the brunt of it when it was going in, and you stayed around the target and called the shots or rebound it, whatever. You would just say, make him call it like a bomber.
Right.
If you had anything left, he'd tell you where to put it.
So what was your second tour was with the Pathfinders then?
It was all with Pathfinders.
It was always Pathfinders.
Except the first seven.
Oh, okay. So for the first seven.
But no, the first four. First four, yeah.
So, you were allowed to go home after the first tour, right? Is that how it was?
No, if you're in Pathfinders, you put two tours, one after the other.
Yeah.
And decided, well, I was into my third one when they told me to quit.
And was that just because the war had ended, or?
Well, no, it was getting close, but I just got a call one morning, and this voice said, the hell is it? It's in one of these chapters I was just sitting on, working on this morning. I got a phone call, and I said, flying out from Gregor? And I said, yes. How many trips have you done? I said, I don't know. I mean, when you get a call from the headquarters and they're asking you a question, a personal question, you're not going to tell them anything. You know, you're suspicious right away. What the hell's wrong?
Yeah.
So I said, I don't know. I said, well, we do. How many points have we got? And I said, points? What are points? And they said, well, we do, and you're grounded right now. I said, what for? I said, can I have your name? He said, no, and he hung up. I knew it was language. So I went to the generator and told him, he said, okay, go see Bingham Hall. He was a group captain, a squadron commander. And he said, hi, Lucky. He said, what can I do for you? So that was a kind of terms I was on with the records of Quarterson. And so I told him, he said, why don't you take my car and drive around down to London and find out just what's what? So he did. He said, he called me on the phone. He said, bring my car around and go down to London in his car. And I would never have found a nice bridge if it hadn't been the driver. He knew everywhere. I went in the place, and the first thing, the thing that struck me was how tidy everything was. Everybody was wearing fresh blue uniforms, looked like they were right out of the stores. And spick and span polish. I went in there, and I was still wearing my battle dress. And there was quite a difference in dress code. So somebody at the front desk said, what can I do for you? I said, I'd like to see somebody in charge, like the top man. He said, what do you want to talk about? I said, operations. He said, what's that? I said, I just told you, operations. By this time, I'm a warrant, I was a flying officer. No, I was a warrant officer. No, I must have been a flying officer. And I was getting pretty cocky. I had the hat in the back of my head and a silk scarf around my neck. I was telling Tommy and some comic called, new favorite comic strip. Aping him, and they just let me go. And by that time, I had a twitch and the nerves, you know. Mm-hmm. This whole left side of my face had just gone. I couldn't stop it. Hmm. It lasted for 3 years after I got out of the service. Well, I didn't pay any attention to it because it just happened. And anyway, I got by him and he sent me somewhere, and a cute little girl in the room, and the other hand was a wing commander pretending to do something. And I walked over, feedback, well, sir, McGregor. He said, oh yes, I heard about you. He said, you're on a goose chase, wild goose chase, kid. I said, why? And he said, because orders are orders. You can only fly, you have to fly one tour, you can volunteer a second, but you can't do a third without top permission. And that's Air Marshal, Anyway. He said, and he's not here. He's back in Canada right now. I said, well, surely the guy must have left somebody to leave in charge, do something. He said, are you questioning our methods down here? Well, there's a word for it, but standard procedures down here. And I said, damn right I am. This is a hell of a way to run a railroad. And Jesus, it was just like I slapped him. He sat back in his chair and he looked at me. And then he turned fatherly and he said, son, he said, relax, sit down. I'm going to tell you a story. He told me the story about two Canadian boys on the prairies. They know each other. The mothers know each other. They go over. They're lucky. They get through a tour each. The first one comes home and he's a hero and whatnot. The other one, he's having fun. God, the girls are handy and the pubs all around the place and he's having fun. He gets lucky. He's not running in and fighting. There's too much fight. So he volunteers for a second one and he gets lucky and gets through that too. But on the third one he starts, he gets shot down. But Mummy doesn't know what he's doing. One boy came home, he said, my boy's having fun running around London, I guess. Well, when she hears he's been done and she finds out how many trips he's done, she's in shock. Why did my boy have to do any more than that one? Mm-hmm. And she calls the Air Force, they don't tell her anything. So she calls her Member of Parliament. And he gets on to it, and things start to move. And they change the rules. You do one, you sign up for it, you can volunteer for a second, but you've got to have top permission to fly a third. And so I relaxed and smiled out. I said, well, sorry, I'm sorry to serve. I said, that sort of makes sense. But he says, orders, you still got to go home. Go home, relax, you've done more than you're there. So I did. But I got home and our crew was scheduled to fly that night. Mm-hmm. High crew was like one that fly maybe 20 missions, but two or one. They were scattered all over the place. I got back and they hadn't heard about my being canceled. So I just walked in on the briefing room with them and took the briefing and went out that night. Well, that's not in the logbook. In the records, it was Flight Sergeant Brown.
Right.
To the adjutant, he knew if anything happened, I could report back. They knew who it was. So, there's just so much in. I'm on page 196 right now on that story. That might be your better idea. When I finish the book, come over and check one.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to.
They'd be all there then.
Yeah. So I get the impression that you didn't really want to leave, and you're quite comfortable staying.
When I get finished?
What was that?
The last trip I was on, a place called Worms. And it was a rest and recreation place for wounded German troops, sailors, airmen, whatever. My wife went there after the war, she was on tour, and she says, I never saw so many people on crutches and things to help you walk around in that town. That place was full of them. They went to do a job. But when they told me what it was for, we were going to bomb them, wounded people, mm-hmm. I just felt something was just growling. I said, shit, this isn't war, that's murder. Mm-hmm. And I said, they used to call head of bomber command Bomber Hare, Butcher Hare. Stuff he sent us in. So I could quit any time and still keep my Pathfinder wing. Mm-hmm. But the Pathfinder people were a separate wing. Yeah, it is here. This is an investiture where they gave me a distinguished flying cross right there, and there's a Pathfinder wing under the gunner's wing.
Yeah.
That's a half a wing. Pilots get a whole wing like that.
Right.
We got half a wing. And people used to ask me, how come you only got half a wing? I said, because it was only a half ass flyer. Under that, under the ribbons, there's a little brass wing, and then under that, there's another one that's got a bar to it. So you find the second tour. And that's the Victoria Cross. That's an Air Force Cross.
Oh, wow.
Kendall. This guy had a DLC, but, and the guy that gave it to us is here. Viscount Alexander, my dad was aide-de-camp for him in Powder when he came up here. He was the most senior officer around. That's what it looked like when I joined up, and that's what it looked like when I came home.
You were young. How old were you there?
18.
18 years old.
My birthday.
Yeah.
A little older. I had this white flash on, but I was 18, but I joined 3 days. I joined on my 18th birthday, but took so long to get to heaven and through the wreck we had that they listed as 25. That white flash, by the way, signified that we were aircrew in training. Well, that helped if you were looking for a girl to go dancing with. The ground crew got a little pissed off with all that, so they got around and they spread the word that anybody with that white flash on their cap has got VDs, they're girls. Well, it was a war within a war.
It's just competition.
Well,
So what were you involved in any of the those 1,000-person raids?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't mark them as 1,000, they were just raised to us.
Yeah.
Was it? To the brass, they were, boy, look what we just did. Looks like they were behind a chair somewhere. I had fun one night with one of these things. Was left with us. Somebody just spent 110. He got 4 20-millimeter cannons. A millimeter and a centimeter, if they were 20 millimeters, that'll be 2 millimeters, which would be about an inch mm-hmm. down in the shell, and 4 cannons there. He could hit us from 1,000 yards out. I could hit him about 600 yards out, but it wasn't very effective with about 3 or 4 bullets, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I got here. But this guy, I saw him way back, 1,000 yards back, I can't say the fire that we set. It was Cobrone, I think, the target. What's that in here? It showed my firepower and his firepower. Which was quite different. But my guns were faster. I could throw 76 bullets a second. Isn't that a good picture? If the guns were bringing a load of bombs to load up a light for the night.
Oh, yeah. Those are the big drum ones, eh?
At the 4,000-pounder.
Yeah.
Behind that would be 1,000-pounder. These would be 500-pounder. Those would be canisters.
So you get loaded up with all different kinds?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Incendiary. You put the big one down, that blasted everything in the kiln, and then you drop the incendiary on it and burn it.
Stayed together most of the time?
Yeah, yeah. Eh?
That crew stayed together the whole time?
They did. I joined them when they were already started.
Mm-hmm.
And they threw me off.
Yeah.
They took me off before I could finish fighting them. They finished the war. They'd done about 75 operations. The British didn't have such a thing as a tour that you were finished.
Awesome.
There he is. That's one of those. Full thing right here.
Right. It's the measurement at 110?
That's what,
That's the 110? The measurement at 110, that's what it...
110, yeah.
Yeah.
And I had four Browning 303s. When they were all booming, I was putting out 76 bullets a second. When I hit him, he was 50 feet below me. And I saw him 1,000 yards behind me. And one of the gunner's jobs was to tell the skipper every aircraft he saw. Mm-hmm. Because if there's another Lank or Halifax, 75 feet off your port bow, there's one over above you, whatnot. So he knew if he had to take evasive action, which way he could go mm-hmm. without hitting somebody. But it was one of them. Important job, I'd say. Mm-hmm. Our job wasn't to shoot down German fighters. Our job was to protect the aircraft and bring it back so it could fly again. Mm-hmm. That was it, period. I'm going to tell you something else I forgot it.
So you shot that plane down then, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. He came in, I saw him, and I'm looking back and forth, the turret looking, swinging to the port of starboard, up and down. And I saw him again. So I took a sighting on him. I could do the way I had with the ring in the little box. I could tell how far away he was. He was 500 yards away. So I said, "Skipper, we got a fighter behind us." "Yeah, I know he's a fighter because nobody else in the sky would be flying that fast." I watched him, he gave him 1,000, 500, 600, 500 yards. I said, "He's still there." And he's obviously locked on us with his radar or something because he's right behind us. So I said, "Let's just see what he's up to." And then he started dropping, sinking down. He stayed about 100 feet below the vision. And now I'm looking in the dark towards him instead of a fire. And his background is dark, but I could see him. I said, "He's down 100 feet and he's staying there." I said, "Start a gentle weave starboard. So we go this way." And he came up right away. "Steady up, straight and level, quick." We straightened up. He stayed there a bit and then he sank down again. And I said, "Well, let's see him. He's about 300 yards out. 100, and then by that I could see him plainly. The stars you and you could see him." And the crew, of course, said, What are you going to do with him? Just leave it be. We'll take care of it. And they, of course, got worms crawling up their ass. I said, "I think he's an intruder. He's going to follow us home. Get in the stack, waiting to land." And with us, with our wheels down, our flaps down, he shall be shooting 6 or 8 of us down at one time. One German pilot got 11 aircraft in 15 minutes, 11 bombers in 15 minutes. Wow. He did brrr, brrr. He get them out like that. It was easy. Mm-hmm. Fish in a barrel. So this guy, he gets a little closer, and pretty soon, I said, "He's right under us, about 100 feet down." I said, "I can't get my guns to bear on him now. But he's obviously going to follow us home. He's hiding under us, so he won't get picked up on radar and think we'll just blend with him." I said, "But he's not going home with us." I said, "When I say go, pull the nose up. That'll allow me to see him. He's right below me. And when you hear my gun, dive starboard." So I said, "Go," and we went up. And I'm sort of sunk in with change in gravity, and I just pulled both fingers and it just raked all these canopies all down here. And I could see the canopies with glass going everywhere. And then we were diving starboard, and of course everything went, "Oh, I don't know what the hell happened." And then I went past his nose. We went right past his nose here, about 15, 25 feet away. I could see the pilot, and I could see the rivets on the side of the aircraft from the flames of my guns. It was that close.
Wow.
It's a wonder we didn't take out of hit his port engine. But he fired right there. He wasn't dead. The pilot wasn't dead. Or at least he may have been dying, but he was alive. And he pulled a finger that we went by and he blew out our port out of our engine, which drove my turret. And so the turret quit moving and started cracking. And then I did give him a couple of shots at him. And he was just falling away, pointing down. He was gone. But I couldn't flame anything. We didn't get a flamer. I never did get a flamer. I shot at a lot of them.
Yeah.
But one night on the last trip, I said to Bill, I said, you know, Skipper, I said, on all the 54 missions I've done, I've never had a flamer. He said, how about a trip around town looking for one? Well, we did. We flew around the target looking for a fighter. We were after him. It was crazy. That's been crazy.
And what city were you guys around then?
Pardon?
What city were you at then? Where were you?
Oh, we're Worms.
Oh, you were in Worms. That was the Worms.
That's where we did that.
Okay.
That one was at Cobron. That was a lot earlier.
Okay.
The fight with them. That was a port then. We got chased by what, Paco 190 over Leipzig or somewhere over there. We got chased by an enemy 410. The Nepper saw him. He was up. I'm sitting this way, mid upper up there, behind me, but the port quarter was that way, the starboard quarter that way. I said, port quarter high, fighter. And I just wanted to turn around and look to see him. And I just lined him up with three radiuses of the wing, fighting, shooting a firing ring ahead of him. I just let them go, and he ran right into it.
Yeah.
Bullets bouncing all over the place, and he just vanished. A lot of them like that. They weren't going to go after a bomber that had them.
Yeah.
If they knew the gunner had a bead on them, they'd bugger off. They weren't, didn't want to die.
Yeah.
And there's an ME 110, a 410, a 190, and an ME 109. We did not attack us, but I saw one. He's out. There's another aircraft here. I'm here. I'm sitting here. This other bomber, we're flying along side by side. He's 400 yards out here. And all of a sudden, out of the dark, comes ME-109, single engine aircraft. More of a day shot fighter, but they were getting desperate to use it tonight too. And he just pulled up right behind the guy and fired. He killed the gunner right away. You could see the rear end of the aircraft tipped in the head. And as the powder passed on into the fuel tanks, and the whole thing blew up, and no parachutes. That wasn't uncommon. But then another one I almost had a whack at. I didn't shoot at it because it my tracer would have disturbed the gun in that other bomber. Mm-hmm. He would have thought somebody's coming from the side. He'd never look where the real problem was.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he just was asleep or he wasn't looking properly. Mm-hmm. It was dark up there sometimes. I remember one night, it was so black, we couldn't see things around us. Just hear this, be flying along, whoom! Oh, you knew you had company and he just passed you. But this one, I saw, I guess there were four or six, it would have been eight exhausts, two on either side of the engine. 16 cylinder engine they had in the Maryland, 2,000 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw them. I said, Skipper, there's a bomber right below us. I don't know what it is. I can't see. I can just see the exhaust on him. He said, okay, just keep an eye on him. If he starts rising or falling, he said, let me know. And we stayed put because if we ride, we'll go in somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I got my sighting ring on it, and the sighting ring just covered one engine. Between two lines of exhaust, which put him something like 50 to 100 feet below us, and I couldn't see him. So that's right, only the exhaust.
Well,
another time, using exhaust, we used vapor trails and moonlight. At 10,000 feet, there's a blanket of cloud. Flat, it's like a flat blanket. We're at 18,000, which is standard flight level. And I could see on that blanket down there hundreds of little black ants crawling across it. It was us, the moon shining down and putting it on there. We were leaving vapor trails, and it's the only thing we left. And I was looking, and then I saw a fighter. Not actually, but I saw his shadow, because it came in fast from one side, and I saw some gunfire, and the shadow ahead of him disappeared.
Huh.
And so I got the pilot to weave a little bit, and I found out which one had shadows with us. And I didn't look in the sky, I just watched the shadows. That's when I knew who was around us.
Huh. That's incredible.
He's whatever age you can find.
Yeah.
Staying alive with them. The worst thing was really Galvin Dominoes, all kinds of them. But I joined up in Edmonton and they told us about it and showed us films. And I went picking the same thing. And it scared the hell out of me. I like to dance, but it scared the hell out of me. They saw your penises literally dropping off and swollen with sores and bugs on them. And, oh God, it was sickening. So I danced a lot, but I came home a virgin. I wasn't going to get involved in any of that. So that was almost a sin, a crime to get caught up. They had condoms and things they told you about, but I said, even that's too close. But people that got BD were committing a crime. Because it took a long time to start and grow and build an airman. Mm-hmm. It took weeks to buy out to build a bomber, mm-hmm. or maybe even less. But you hurt the man who drives it, and he's out of commission. He just helped the Germans.
Yeah.
And there were always there was a guy one afternoon. Paddy O'Brien was an air gunner. He was about 6 feet tall, and his hands hung down to his knees. Big long arms. Wide shouldered, flat chested Irishman. And it was the no flying day, because the saw a fog within or something. And they put us all in the room and said, they've got people within the group that were, what they were doing, parallel work. Interesting story. And this guy was a doctor in training. And he was talking about genealogy. And when he was just about finished, Paddy's put his hand up and he said, "Yes, sir, what do you want?" He said, "Do you believe in Darwin's theory of evolution?" He's looking at him, hanging on my feet, like Dave. The whole room exploded. Oh, God.
Yeah, it's good.
We got back to Laval, Lachine, about 20, 30 miles south of Montreal, down the river. And we'd gone through the war, come home, we're in our battle vest, and we were just getting paperwork and stuff at Lachine and then on the train home. But six of us went out for a beer one night. We went to a pub and the Air Force and the service was pure scum in Montreal. Mm-hmm. We went in there and they were quite rather rude. And we all had a beer. And two flight attendants came in, spick and polish types, administrator, no wings, no nothing. They stood at the bar and they were discussing the merits of wartime aircrew and the dirty battle dress and whatnot, and the way they walked, and they were just giving us a hard time. So one of us said, "You know, the way those guys are talking about dressing, I found we didn't give them a dressing down." So we surrounded them, tore all the clothes off them, left them bare naked on the floor without hope, laughing their heads off them because they had nothing to be proud about.
That was great.
There was a lot of fun, and that's what you remember. You don't. It's. Even the body is an amazing piece of work. I'll bet you can't tell me what your worst pain was, and you can't feel it anymore. It's gone. Mm-hmm. You can't take it out. But the good things that happened, you can remember all them.
Yeah.
But if you're hurt somewhere, and I just have both thumbs run through a chainsaw. I've had a bullet in the back of my neck. I've had, oh, Christ, that's when you cut some bruises. That's funny. Hurt at the time, but not anymore, and I can't bring back the feeling of what it felt. Mm-hmm. Nobody can. It's an amazing piece of work we have.
That's true.
Yeah. That wreath there The big four, the big five poppies at the bottom and the old one at the top is what is on there. Mm-hmm. I take it down every armistice, Johnny Marsh in the parade, but I go down early and put this on. All the little ones across the top, people who were at the parade, the Santa, came up and parked those on there. They knew what for valor meant. Because that's what's written on a VC, mm-hmm. Victoria Cross. That's all there is on it.
Right.
And my daddy had one. He had four.
Wow.
He had a Victoria Cross, two military crosses, and a Distinguished Conduct Medal. And while the Distinguished Conduct Medal comes last in the listing of prestige mm-hmm. only, because officers get crosses and men get medals. Mm-hmm. And that particular one is right next to the VC. It's worth two or three of the military crosses, or the military crosses. He was Canada's most decorated soldier ever.
Wow.
And that's a hard one to grow up under.
Yeah, tell me about it.
That's why I joined the Air Force. He was in the Army again.
Did you ever catch any flack about that, about having your dad? Did you ever catch any flack about that, having your dad so highly decorated? Your friends?
I grew up with it from the day I was born. I put up with it.
Yeah.
The other kids, so you take your old man's stuff, hey, why did you beat me up? Eventually, Dad said, I was black eyed and beaten up and torn. And he said, Mom says, you're a hard act to follow, Jock. He says, what can you do? And he said, I'll think on it. And he did. And then he gave me a 7-foot crosscut saw, a 12-pound hammer, two steel wedges and a double-bitted axe. He said, you're in charge of the winter wood supply now, son. So he took me in the woods and showed me how to do it and how to keep the saw from getting stuck, keeping the turpentine in and kind of like the pitch. And he told me how to cut trees down and better still get ones that were already down. The big wind in 28 that went through Powder River, the Turkey Hurricane went through there, and trees falling down all over the place. Roots in the east, tops in the west. You can go through the bush there and you know which tree or deer it was. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. Well, I got pretty good at that. I was about 200, 300 yards from home. I cut them into blocks, 4 feet long. Split them, because they were like wedges. Because mm-hmm. I couldn't lift the block, but I could lift one end up. I'd push it forward, come it. I took three or four at a time, put it apart. And that's how we got wood for the winter. Tumble, tumble, all the way home. Go back and get another load. That's why I didn't go to a game with the other kids. I was busy working all the time. And besides, I was always looked at it. I felt like a pariah. And Dad did too, for instance. When I came home, he took me down to join the Legion. One of the items on the agenda was, it was near Thanksgiving time, we should have a game dinner. Anybody got any ideas? Nobody. And finally Dad stood up. He said, well, gentlemen, he said, we're all hunters and fishermen around here. He said, why not have a game dinner? And he said, and there's vegetables. I said, not much, I don't have a gun anymore, but I know a lot of you catch salmon, big salmon off the dock. And you'll get goat and bear and everything else around here. He said, I can donate a sack of potatoes, for instance. And he sat down. Nobody else said a word. The chairman said, well, if that's all we got, he said, that's all the next thing. We were just ostracized. And yet he was always asked to greet ships coming into Powder River, Navy ships. When they came up and they put all the sailors along the railing and they head of the town, the manager, he called down to get Jock off the mechanical gang, it wasn't the millwrights. He said, get them out there. They had a locker down there on the dock with a bowler hat, plenty polished shoes his size, and a black pinstripe suit. Get them dressed. And he'd go down there for them and he'd greet the boat. They'd put them on the play out in front of the warehouses in the dock. Destroyer come in and whatnot, and feathers all saluting. I still don't know whether they're saluting the man or the metal. Anyway, that was, he was a senior one there, and it was expected of him. And he'd played along with it, he hated it. But the dock workers, watching it, go home and tell their folks at dinner time, and the kids would hear it. I go to school next door and I get beaten up.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, this is. But, you don't know whether it's jealousy, I don't know what, there's a word for it, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
But, when I hear the net beat, when I got home after the war, I stopped in Winnipeg. My girlfriend I left behind had a dozen roses. Picked her up. I said, where's your boss? She said, up there. Carried up and carried up to the boss's office. And I said, good afternoon, sir. This girl I'm taking home to Palo to marry tomorrow morning. Would you mind packaging up her what pay she has coming and sending on to her mother? He says, no problem, son, I heard about you. He says, good luck, congratulations on your day. And I went out with her. We got a train out there. Well, we took a day coach, because we didn't have that much money. And so we have an in Vancouver, and I went to see some old friends, mother's friends in Vancouver, and we're not sure whose son had been lost, and I went to see her. She felt kind of bad when I showed up because her son never was. We got home. I went down to the courthouse to get a marriage license. He said, how old are you? I said, 1 week short of 21. He said, sorry, we can't, you're too young, you can't have it till you're 21. I said, what the hell are you telling me? You're sitting there going on your fat ass and I've been over fighting a war for you and I can't even get married? He said, the law is the law, son. He said, your dad's got a sign for you. So we had to get a telegraph off to Victoria to give a dad to send the word out. Which we got squared away. And then I went down to the liquor store and won a bottle of rum for a reception afterwards. And the clerk says, how old are you? I said, a week short of 21. He says, sorry, you got to be 21. My son getting married tomorrow and I need a bottle of rum. He said, I can't give it to you, sir. That's the law. So I turned around to the group, there was maybe 20 guys in the hall, in the store. I was far away, the most decorated one. And I said, hey guys, and a lot of them were old acquaintances. I never had friends in Bollywood, the acquaintances. I was too busy. I said, hey, this guy won't tell me a bottle of rum for my marriage tomorrow. And he says, I'm not old enough. Well, just like one person, like one. Oh, he won't he? And they advanced, the guy was terrified. Because that happened in Halifax, and they literally took him apart, and they took the whole store, emptied it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, he said, okay, you're committing perjury, sign here. You know? I said, take your perjury and shove it. I was getting pretty cocky, I guess, by that time. But back home, they took it out of me. It was, one other chap, Harry Dunkersley, who was 2 years ahead of me in school, won a DFC and a bar flying fighters for Spider over Malta. When he came home, he was flying a beach expediter, a beach aircraft, from Calgary to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And he's still somewhere in the snows up there. He never found me, never got to Vancouver.
Oh, really?
And I was the only other one that got decorated in town. That a hell of a lot of guys joined up. And I was like left alone. And like Dad did, they gave me a hard time over here too. But a lot of memories I do that. I don't know what to tell you. Well, folks, and I got married there. It lasted 25 years. And then things went bad. Another lady asked me to marry her, and I wasn't doing anything, and she needed help. I said, okay. That's just how dumb I am. And then finally, I ran into this one and got lucky. We've been married over 25 years now. People say, how many years have you been married, Jen? I said, well, 25, 60 years. I said, really? Yeah, I said, no, it's the same woman.
Three time lucky?
Right, he's a spice of life.
Lucky number three is just...
That's number three. Oh, everything happened to me in threes.
Yeah.
I saw Jaws last night, and it finally sank in. I'd seen it three times before, but it finally sunk in how stupid I was. Because I harpooned a shark that big from a 14-foot rowboat.
Yeah.
Out off Harvard Island. It was a mud shark. He was basking asleep in the sun.
Oh, really?
How did they do that? And by 1941, the scientists figured out that sharks have the biggest liver of any creature for size in the world.
Yeah.
And their content is every bit as good as cod liver oil, so the hunt was on for sharks. They were easy to find.
Yeah.
And the ship has cod liver oil over the troops, keeping it healthy and whatnot. And I'm cutting firewood, taking my 14-foot boat up the Lake Powell Lake, cutting down snags, old dead trees. And I didn't know that the bark on them could fall down on you and kill you, but I cut them down anyway. Skid them down the mountain, Daddy Gilchrist Jack, I could lift 40,000 pounds with it. In the lake, cut them and tie them behind my rowboat and tow them down to my log boom. Most I went was about three miles. But it would sometimes take me a day and a half to get down there. And cut them into 40-foot length, put them in the boom, and roll them up a ramp onto a platform at a cranking winch. And then we cut one of the hands into 14-foot blocks, split them into piles 8 feet long, 4 feet high, and 4 feet wide. That's a cord. $2.
Oh, gosh.
I came home and I was just, they discovered the chainsaw by that time, and I got big ideas. There's a lot of those old snags are up and down the coast there. They die and they don't log them. And I had trouble with a chainsaw and a little power boat. I could make an empire down there. So I got home and three homesteaders had parked their houseboats in my log puma pond. They'd stolen the big bull block off the top. It was worth over $1,000. They'd taken the winch off the hill and there was nothing left. I never had title to the place. I just bought it from the guy that had it before me.
Right.
Things were easy in those days. Nobody sued anybody. You didn't, life was nice. You could leave your doors open.
Yeah.
If you had a cabin in the woods, you'd leave it open.
Yeah.
They shouldn't have everything. Others come and buy a cotton rainfire, you're welcome to use it. If you use up the wood, cut someone. Replace it. And that's how we lived in those days. Up in Holberg, I was there 4 years. And took all the trails up there. I've been on every trail in the town. But when the second tour up there, I did one tour at first and then went back for another year. When I went back, things were different. There were a new breed of people. City kids coming up there and we carried rifles for protection against cougars. Mm-hmm. Or maybe take a crow's home or something. He didn't shoot the bear because it took 22 in there to hurt a bear.
Right.
And we had 21 bears at the dump on the station anyway. Three families. Two families and a single.
Yeah.
And Pluth was a character. But the cabins that were left up and down the trail were being smashed. One kid, I was down at what's called Slaughter Pool, it's a fish hole. It's all kinds of fish. And I'm casting away, and the bridge is upstream a little bit, and I hear this crack. Psh! Fucking bullet, it bounces off the water down there, it goes on downstream. I got behind a big cedar, and I look around, and there's somebody firing off the bridge, an airman. Just a son of a bitch. So I got back in the bush, I went out and came up behind him, and I walked out the ground. He says, hi, how's the shooting today? He says, oh, good. He says, not much around. I said, can I try it? He said, sure. He handed me the gun. I clicked it open, took it by the barrel, and I broke it over the bridge rail and dumped it in the river. And he said, what the fuck are you doing? I said, I could have you arrested, you know. I just don't want you shooting anymore. That's against the law. It's against any law of common sense. There's people fishing down there, and you hit one and kill them, how are you going to feel? Mm-hmm. He never reported me. I legally had the right to do it, but I never paid much attention to what was legal. What was right was the thing, you know.
So I was just going to ask you, I don't know how much longer you want to go for.
Hey, I'm here all day.
Okay, well, just to get back to the war, just briefly, I just wanted to focus on, like, one mission or something. Maybe I can write about it. What mission, I'm just trying to think of a mission that would be in history books that I can compare and write. Were you involved in a major bombing in Cologne? I guess that was in 42.
Yeah, Cologne was a... We were deputy master bomber that night, and Cologne was a tribute to Norman architect. Beautiful building. Mm-hmm. And our skipper was told, if there's any way you can figure out to not hit the cathedral, he said, do it. So we go over there, and we're thinking, oh, nobody's got any idea. And about 5 minutes ago, the skipper says, I got it. He said, everybody's up at 18,000 feet. I said, we'll go down to 2,000 feet, turn on all our lights, and fly around the cathedral. So we did, and we got down there, and he told it, Master Barber what he was going to do, and he said, I'm going to put my lights on, and you tell the main force. He was lightning one, and we were lightning two, and main force with thunder. And I heard him call out, and he said, thunder? He says, there's a stupid son of a bitch down there, he's going to turn all these lights on, he's going to fly around the cathedral. And he said, and that's lightning two. And he told me that if any of you guys drop a bomb anywhere near him, he's going to be quite perturbed. So we did. And you know, the Germans fired all kinds of guns at us, 20 millimeters and machine guns and everything. We were only 2,000 feet up. Mm-hmm. We're flying around the spire. All lights on, landing lights, everything. They never hit us. Now, whether they were tracking us, and because we were on a curve like this, they were always shooting, leading ahead to where we're going to be. Mm-hmm. But they're over here. We keep going this way, and they're always. That could be one reason. Or the other might have been the Germans knew what we were doing, and they wanted the cathedral kept too. Mm-hmm. So they fired wide. They had to fire because the brass were, their bosses would have killed them for not doing the duty. But we never got hit. But we got home, and the skipper, Bill Cleland, got recommended for and lauded for a distinguished service order. And the rest of us? We got a new set of underwear.
So that was in 42 then?
That was...
Which one was next? I read about a Cologne bombing in 42 that was led by Harris, but you said you weren't didn't do missions until 43, right?
Did I have glasses on when I came down here? Yeah, that was good. Yeah. I was 60 years old. I had my cataracts on here last year, and I can't see things up short, but I looked over the island there when I came home, and I said to Betty, I said, by God, that's 5 miles away.
Yeah.
I said, I just saw a pine needle fall into a fir tree. I told that to my doctor, and he said, yeah, it was on the other side of the island, too. Cologne. Koblenz, Cologne, here we are. This one was 30th of December, 44.
So, just to clarify, did the Pathfinders carry only the flares, or did they have the bombs?
Oh, no, we carried bombs and everything.
Okay, so you dropped the flares, and then you dropped the bombs after.
You dropped the flares
to
mark the target.
Right.
And we dropped other flares. Visual Center was called, which dropped the first flare and keep the main captain. The master bomber would call in other aircraft to keep it marked. But we also carried, the first one then would carry 500 pounders, maybe a cookie, and the rest would all be 500 pounders. Mm-hmm. And we scattered them. Our job was to go in, those people, to break down the defenses before the main force came in. That's why we only had to do 20 tours for the 20 trips for the second tour. And we just stirred things up. Trains of thought come and go with me.
That's all right. So, did you? How was the accuracy of the bombs? Did you find?
We were pretty good.
Yeah.
But we had H2S. H2S was to describe it, it was a flying radar. We looked down at the earth. Mm-hmm. And rivers, lakes, roofs of houses, things like that, we could see them plainly on the radar. And you knew the size of the town, we studied that before we went out. And when that came up, that was a town. You know where the real yards were, the ball bearing factories or whatever. And I have, a lot of the guys I flew with, nobody balked at the flak or anything. You know, you're flying along and boom, 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 it's all over you, and the aircraft is shaking with explosions. But the bombardier has a control to that side. He just lays there and he just watches it creep up on that, and the bomb door is open. You got it through the crosshair and let it go. And we take pictures of that because every bomb you drop, mm-hmm. you drop a flare, a thunder flash, mm-hmm. which is just like a flash on a camera. And it took a picture of what you did. And the Pathfinders were exceptional at that. They were trained, and they trained all the time. They didn't just, okay, we're here now, we're in the next mission. We had hell. Any patient, if we had them. On the 3rd of March, 44, in Lancaster, T for Tommy, number 559, which was near Woburn. He was the guy who was going to fly with the ambassadors. I came down with scarlet fever, and he went on, and he crashed in the hills of Scotland, crashed thing for that raid.
Oh, yeah.
Fighter affiliation. SBAs. What the hell was that? SBA, I forgot what it was. And local flying. Simulated bomb attacks, I think. And across country, we landed at Derby. Oh, jeez, that guy was crazy. At fighter affiliation, we had a Mustang nearby. And he'd come up and attack us, and we'd crash into evasive action. Mm-hmm. And another day, you got... And some months without anything going there. Yeah, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 6 operations in May 1944. And then we had an air test and H2S runs, night fighter training, Y runs, NFT 3 times, and air-to-air firing, and bombing. Well, I'll tell you something that was unique at. Gunnery. I did a score of 43% accuracy test with a machine gun, which is unheard of because the machine gun bounces around so much. Mm-hmm. So the pedestal just goes bang, 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 brrrr, and it's all over the place. Mm-hmm. I had 4 of them, so we were going out for a test one day. I'd been watching, keep my eye on what happened. I walked around the night around the perimeter of the airfield, counting insulators on poles and things like that in the dark. And I guess you can see in the dark if you know how. Mm-hmm. And I practiced in there was a room there with a projector, and it was a film of fighters coming out of the dark at you. And you don't know where they were coming, you just watch and you see just a little flicker, a piece of something dark, something that you learn how to see at night. And I spent a lot of time there instead of going down to pubs. Most of the guys didn't bother with that. What the fuck, that's nothing at all. But I spent my time on the base practicing. And my mother said, I want you to come home now. Anyway, that and we ate a lot of carrots to make good for your eyeball.
Also the night vision.
Yeah. And oh, what else? I don't know. Anyway, with that, and then we harmonized our guns. Harmonized is setting them up so they'll provide a certain density at a distance. It was a board about the size of a half a sheet of plywood, mm-hmm. 4x4 4x4. Top right-hand corner, don't quote me on which is which, I forgot, but a red, yellow, blue, and a green in the bottom of each corner. in the middle of the next. You walked out 400 yards behind your aircraft, set up the board, and then you crank the thing around till you could put the X, lock your turret and the stern, twiddling a few knobs, you got the sighting on the X in the middle. And then you took the breech blocks out, one after the other, took them out, took the back plate off when you looked down, and with little twiddly screws in there, you could line up that barrel on the top right, top left-hand corner, same in the top right and the bottom right, bottom left. Mm-hmm. Lock everything up tight, clamp it down. You've now got a 22-foot-6 density at 400 yards, where most of your bullets are going to be. Well, about the average tests on space like that was 6% bullets that hit the drone. And in flying training in McDonald, we used to, in Perry battle aircraft, we'd tow a drogue, one would tow a drogue behind it, and we'd be up top with a Vickers machine gun with a canister on top. We'd load it ourselves all over the place. The guns were old, the barrels were worn out, and the bullets were going there like as long as they are. But I said, this is, why do that? I'm practicing turret manipulation and looking and sighting and everything all the time. Mm-hmm. I went out and I put a marker at the X out there 400 yards, came back, I would like all the guns on the middle. Instead of a shotgun, I threw the rifle.
Yeah.
When I hit something, it went. And I was called down to the Chief Air Force Marshal Bennett, head of the Pathfinder, to explain a 43% gunnery exercise. And so I told him how I do it, why I do it, and everything. And he says, well, he says, we have our rules. He says, for you, it seems to work. But we must have regulations or procedures. He said, don't tell anybody. He said, they all start doing their own thing and everything will go to hell. He said, in the meantime, good luck, Lockie. It's from an Air Vice Marshal. I didn't know he even knew my nickname. He said, good luck, Lockie. And I saluted him back out as fast as I could. And when I did, it was I fired at a German fighter. I fired at a few of them. Mm-hmm. They didn't press it on. They didn't want to come on a fight. They just piss off. Mm-hmm. See, that many bullets coming at them. They're not going to hang around. I think we're the only one bomber command that did that.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, when for pretty much the entire campaign, was the strategic bombing, was it precision bombing or was it more area bombing?
Well, I can answer that a dozen ways.
Yeah.
We tried to be accurate. If we could light up the target, go in and drop flares all over the place, white flares, and then just light up the ground below so the after bomber could find the target, the aiming point. When he did that, he'd call in somebody to mark it. At the same time, there were other ways to do it. Mosquito aircraft. They were built out of spruce from the Queen Charlotte Islands. Mm-hmm. I just had about a fit walking by a hangar one day and here's a guy with a can of glue and a saw fixing an airplane. So, anyway, they were very fast. They were twice as fast as we were. And they were so fast the Germans couldn't catch them. And they flew at 30,000 feet.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, there was one morning we came into work at in the gun room. What's new? And he said, quite two mosquitoes got shot at last night. One of them got hit in the nose and the other got hit in the tail. And the Arabs went out and looked, and what they found was another German fighter bullet, pieces of the tail of one and the nose of the other. And there was only about four of them out there, and yet they collided.
Yeah.
We got there with 1,000 and fly around. And there were a lot more collisions than people ever knew.
Right.
Dead men don't tell any tales. But, I got off track of what you asked.
So was it strategic or was it more area bombing?
No, area? We didn't. We tried to be precision,
yeah,
hitting the target, and that's why we had to keep the target marked, because people being people and they're scared, they get close enough and they just hit, drop the bombs here and let's go. And if the one behind him did the same thing, pretty soon the target's here and the bombing here.
Yeah.
So we have to be in a remark it up here.
Yeah.
What it means to keep the target marked. And we got pretty good. The bombing was pretty good. The Americans are just, they carpet bombed.
Yeah.
Their lead bombardier, when he pulled the trigger, they all did, the whole squadron.
Right.
And if that's half a mile or a mile wide, whatever they were looking at, did they have a specific target? We had mosquitoes dropping flares at a railway junction where two rails come together. Mm-hmm. They were that good. From 30,000. But they were riding a beam from southern England out across the target. Another one from farther up England, or even Scotland, I forget where, would intercept the first beam right over the target. So you had two beams crossing. Mm-hmm. He's riding one, and when he hears the other one, bang, let the bombs go, and he's over the target.
Right.
So I think that was called OBO.
OBO?
OBO. OBOE.
So did you feel that the RAS strategy was a lot more accurate then?
Than the Yanks?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But we didn't. All our bombing, we flew individually. There were no squadrons or no flights or nothing. You had your target and you had to find your way there and do it. The fast finders helped you with it to get accuracy. But the Yanks did some good work, but their job was not. Ours was strategic bombing, mm-hmm. as against tactical bombing. Strategic is the war machine in whole. Factories, and submarine pens, stuff like that. Tactical bombing is hitting moving trains and things that are actually part of the war in process. Ours was bombing on them. God knows how many innocent people we killed, mm-hmm. brought in from outside countries as slaves. And when bombs would the raids went on, they had to stay in their jobs and do it. And it was a shitty war. I was going to tell you one about something in the middle of that. The American bombing.
Talking about the American bombing being hitting tactical, the RAF, strategic.
Yeah. Oh, I know what it was. The American job was to take on the German fighter aircraft. And they had lots of them. They were good. So we're at night, harder to find, but they'd shoot on an average at anywhere between 30 and 40 aircraft of ours they'd shoot down every night. Sometimes a few less, sometimes a few more. The Yanks went out in daylight in formation, staggered so that their gunfire was, they could cover the whole sky with .5 guns, which are nearly twice the size of ours. They were 0.5, ours were 0.303. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the size of the slug, theirs is about four times bigger. I don't know. That's the way it looked. And they can hit farther out than we could. Mm-hmm. And their job was to take on the German Air Force. Ours was strategic bombing. It was a tactical Air Force. I think that was five group that took on the actual war on the ground, shooting up convoys and stuff like that. There's a part, this is a combined story. It had to do with the invasion. And they knew it was virtually impossible unless they achieved two things, primarily. Three. Number one, surprise. Number two, supremacy of the air. And number three, control of communications. Communications covered roads, wireless, and more than anything, the railways. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of bridges in Europe, mm-hmm. over the viaducts over these long valleys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen those.
Built by the Romans, and you could pound them with 1,000 pounders or 4,000 pounders, and the rocks just got tighter together. Well, Barnes Wallace, who invented the bomb that did the dam busters, mm-hmm. also invented the tall boy. Titanium head, tougher cell. It was, I think it was something like 30 feet long. And I don't know what it weighed, something like 12 tons. Sharp, hard steel head on it. It was designed to penetrate 22 feet of reinforced concrete over the submarine bends along the Atlantic Wall. And as it turned out, they blew up a lot of concrete, but they didn't hurt many submarines underneath. The rocks could fall on them, but it wasn't hurting anything. But the bomb itself turned out very useful for the invasion, because the railways, those viaducts, were part of the communication. German tank battalions traveled by rail. They didn't putt-putt around the country. They went by rail. Mm-hmm. Now, when they had that Nuremberg raid, they lost 96 aircraft, 97. That's another part of this. Forget, remember the first part.
Okay.
The second part, maybe the first part, they sent us out to Nuremberg and they told the Germans we were coming. Hitler had a favorite spy and the British knew who he was. And they told him, Nuremberg target, the altitude, the route, everything, timing, how many aircraft. And when we got to the French coast, they were just waiting for us. Like bees waiting for a fly to come in, a dragonfly waiting for a little mosquito to come by or something. And they hounded us there and back. See, there's another one. God, there's another one going down over there. They're all over the place. Well, when it turned out so successful, Hitler's belief in this spy was really cemented. And then, to help the communication bit, Baron Roman, or Lord Walsh's convoy, a group captain, Cheshire, who later afterward tried to build peaceful homes, he was on board the Enola Gay when they bombed the, dropped the first atomic bomb as an observer. He took one of these 12,000 pound tall boys, and the land over in Europe is soft, chalky. And he just figured out, I'll dive bomb the bastard. And he took that bomb and he dive bombed the Lancaster, and named just beside the caissons that were holding the thing up. He put one between two caissons and they'd go down 200 feet under the earth before it blew up. And phew, the bridge fell into it. He didn't build those things in a hurry. He was taking them out all over the place. So the Germans couldn't move the tanks. Then when the invasion was on its way, we went out. We didn't want too many aircraft because it would have, we'd be hitting each other in the early morning. We went up and we flew up and down the channel, English Channel. Because Hitler, a private spy, had been told the invasion will be at Calais. Mm-hmm. It was the obvious place to be. It was the shortest, nothing else. And weather, it's so bad over there. 4,000 ships out there tossing around in a bad storm, they had a hell of a time. So Hitler kept the Panzer Division with their 88mm guns at Calais. And when he was told, they're coming, it was us. We could see on their radar, we dropped chaff, which were thin strips of sort of silver foil, cut to a frequency of the German radar. We dropped them in bundles, maybe 1,000 to a bundle, or 2,000, we dropped boxes of them. And it just fluttered down and covered the whole bloody sea out there. So German radar saw this, I don't know why, it was up or down by way, but they saw this whole great bloody fleet moving towards them at about 6 knots. Mm-hmm. We just go up and come back down almost the same track. Covered it up, just kept it blanketed. And they saw this and they read it, my God, they're coming, you know. And down south, the people who were seeing the actual raiding coming in, they said, Jesus, they're here. And Hitler's people, with the people up in Cali, said, no, he said, that's a fake. The real one's going to come here. And that's how it went. And Hitler would not release the tanks from Calais to come down to wherever the hell we were.
Yeah. Down in Normandy? Or?
Normandy, yeah.
Yeah.
He kept the tanks. If the tanks had got down there, nobody would have gone ashore. 88mm gun at the moment. You could shoot it straight up and down, around and around, everywhere. And it's just so accurate and deadly. Landing boats would have been blasted to pieces one after the other.
secret story.
And that's how the invasion got away with how few casualties they did.
And so that was obviously June 6, 1944. That was in 1944, June 6th.
Yeah. I was in London on the 6th of June. I came out, I'd just seen the first bud bomb. Mm. And I'd seen, been raised down there before, but I'd never seen a bud bomb. But that night, I'd just come back from dancing and the alarm went off. I've got one of those. Up here. I said, well, I'm going to go down the doorway and have a look, see what's happening. And I went down the hotel I stayed in, Highway Garden, and take over from the troops under this rank of water war doctor. If you're a rank above that, you had to go out and buy your own place. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm down the doorway and I see this aircraft coming, and the guns in Hyde Park are going boom, 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 and there's flak falling all over the place. I had a piece of it, one for about a souvenir, I don't know where it was now. But it's like rain coming down through the trees and the rocks. And this aircraft's coming down, pop, 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 like an old German, first original Japanese motorcycle. So it was a pop, 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 pop. And there's fire behind it. And I said, hey, wait, they got him. And then the fire went out and he stopped. Boom. Oh shit, they got him. He had another little bomb in Lafayette. We didn't know what it was. I didn't. I thought it was an aircraft shot down.
Yeah.
Next morning I got up and I went down the radio off. They said, it's still on. They're still coming. I said, what are they? They said, nobody knows. They just come over, the engine stopped, and they dropped wherever the engine stopped. They call them V1. And that went on for a while, right to the end of the war. Fighter pilots were set up along the Thames, because most of you were dropping around London, and these fighter pilots were up there to shoot them down. But they had the Typhoon was the only one that could catch one of these things. They were pretty fast. They had a ramjet engine on the back. That's all. A simple thing. Mm-hmm. Just like a dropping gas in a Venturi here, light it, and it blows out the back and produces push. Mm-hmm. Then they had a lot of ACAC batteries down that area too. But the story I was going to tell you about down there was some of the Typhoon squadron got pretty accurate, and Churchill came down to congratulate them. And they put up a big marquee down there somewhere along the river. And about a lot of press people, of course, and all this. And Ernest Hemingway was there. And he asked Churchill, he said, sir, is it true that you drink enough scotch to sink a British battleship? Churchill picked up a fork and he waved at him. He said, sir, it is people of your ilk spreading false rumors that could lose this war. I'll have you know I drank enough scotch to sink the whole goddamn British fleet. Oh boy. I was down at one time when the invasion was, what was the reason for? One of Churchill's speeches anyway, and he was good, God he was good. But he started this one with, men of the Army and Navy and gentlemen of the Air Force. I said, holy shit, that went home. We're right. Well, you're a gentleman, are you? Whap, whap. Running with a battlefield. I just went back to his father's pass where you go. He really pulled a booby there. When we were in battle, it was tough, but out of battle, we weren't sleeping in mud and trenches like some of the Army. Or freezing rain, a sailor put up on.
Right.
The Murmansk run, where they get so much ice on it, the boat would turn over. I had a friend went to school with them, was on that run. He said, all we did day long and all night, accidents and breaking the ice off the rigging and whatnot.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. He said that what the long range aircraft that Germans had and the submarine was nearly as dangerous as that bloody ice. Mm-hmm. And coal? Oh, you can imagine. And the rough, just the rough planning is there. They have shorter waves for some reason. Pacific waves are longer. Mm-hmm. They wait for the length of time they go. I flew a Canso aircraft, a TBY, out of, the pilot got it airborne, but he was drunk from the night before. And we were doing an exercise on the river core where we relied on the public to spot aircraft and phone in and tell us where they were. So he says, nobody else on the station, he had to do this mission, and he didn't have anybody with him, no crew. And I was down there looking for flying time, and he says, hell, he says, you got three wings, you must be able to fly. He says, come with me. I took this Canso up. He went to sleep, he said, take it around Vancouver and drop in and see the logging camps and the lighthouses. So I'm having a ball up there, I'm just flying up there, I know all the coast anyway. Mm-hmm. Got around the top, and the trial island up there, around the outside, going into valleys, look at a logging camp. I damn near got nailed by a big cable across one inlet. And I was coming in. It was on the starboard side of the inlet, and I was coming in a little high, almost on level with it. I saw this thing almost in front of me, and I said, "Holy fuck! Nobody told me about these." So I went over top of it because it was on my head, and I speak over it. But to get out of there, you know, the inlet's going like that. I just took the wing down and went underneath it on the way, and then on those again. Pilot never woke up. He's still soaring away there. We get down past the big block of land that sticks out there. I can't remember it now. Can't think about it. Anyway, we got back to Raftapino. And there's a pretty good swell going. And the swells are about 200 feet apart. But they don't look like swells, it just rises in water. But when they get in and the wave feels bottom, the foot of the wave feels bottom, it pushes it up, it slows it down, and the water behind it pushes it up, and you get the big goddamn comber coming in. But he woke up, Bob Jasper was his name, and he looked out the window, and I'm 6 feet over the water, flying up and down these waves, the Canso, which wobbles around anyway. He looked down and he said, and talk about a guy being cool. He just said, by the way, Lucky, he says, these aircraft don't land at flying speed. So he said, oh. Oh, dear.
There you go. All right, well, I think
I got
around here for this interview.
Well, if you run out, come on back and we'll...
Oh, yeah, I might take you up on that, but thank you very much. That's very good.
Do you want to read the book? It's... You can read it right off here.